Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. Dr. McCulloch, I was really hoping we could kick off just by you talking a little bit about your experience when women come to you with PCOS, because I imagine a lot of them come to you maybe as a first port of call, but maybe also after they've been down the traditional medical route and seen their GP, seen their doctor. What are women saying to you when it is the latter? They have gone and sought traditional Western medicine approaches already. Are they told that they need to medicate the contraceptive pill or insulin resistance medication? What is the kind of vibe, the anecdotal experience you're getting when women are coming to you about this?
Yeah, I would say for the most part, most patients, when they come in and they've already been through the traditional medical system, they're pretty frustrated, but also confused because they're often offered really two different things. One is the oral contraceptive pill, and that's often offered to them right as soon as they're diagnosed. And often there's not a lot of other investigations done. So the oral contraceptive pill is just sort of across the board offered as a treatment. And then the other is medications for insulin resistance. And a lot of patients are very overwhelmed with being diagnosed with this condition because it's very complex. And, you know, just being offered these two options, there's a lot of negatives to both of them, but also they can kind of cover up underlying problems that can be, you know, worked on or fixed. So I would say there's a combination of feeling dismissed, also confused, and really not being understood or heard.
Has there been enough progress since you first started in this space? Because you've been around for a little while now. Is the needle moving at all? Or are the experiences that you're hearing about still very, very similar? It's the medicate first without really looking at the complexity or the individualization of each case.
Yeah, so I've been doing this for 22 years now. So I would say that there has been a huge amount of progress because when I first started, a lot of people did not even know what PCOS was. And for a condition that affects 10 to 18% of women, it's really, really common. And for many patients back then, they didn't even know or were never even diagnosed with PCOS. That's actually still true now. About 50% are undiagnosed. But I would say that there is a lot of awareness now. Social media has really done a lot. So patients are quite aware. And the research is starting to improve quite a bit. That being said, for all of that to trickle into clinical care takes a lot of time. So I would say the clinical element is somewhat similar in that those treatment options that are being offered are still similar. But the awareness that patients have is so much more. And patients are just doing so much of their own research now. So yeah, we're definitely seeing some shifts happening, which is great.
As you say, it's fantastic that there is the greater awareness and more women taking more control. But it sounds as though the big obstacle remains the clinical setting. It's still, there's not been a huge amount of change there. I know it's an incredibly difficult conversation and difficult subject, but why do you think there is that resistance there? Is it because PCOS can manifest itself so differently for an individual, or do you think there's other reasons behind it?
I think that that's very true in that it really manifests differently around, you know, for different people at different times in life. And I think that it's also very confusing for medical professionals who often even now still view it as a condition around ovarian cysts that's diagnosed by ultrasound rather than an endocrine disorder. So a lot of physicians may not have as much time to really understand PCOS. So they tend to follow the guidelines for the standard of care. And the guidelines have been, you know, they're based on research. And unfortunately, the research is also not as much as we need for a common condition like this. So we're seeing about 0.1% of all NIH research goes to PCOS, yet it affects, 10 to 18% of patients. So there's not enough research to trickle into like these clinical guidelines, which are basically what MDs have time to read. So we did have some new guidelines released this year because there has been research. So hopefully that will improve things in the future, but that sort of summarizes why this whole situation is like this.
I've spoken to a number of experts in this area around PCOS, and the general trend is a little bit negative, that they don't feel like there's going to be any kind of seismic shift anytime soon, because there's just not the impetus, there's just not the desire to find better treatments, let alone a cure. Would you go along with that assessment of the current state of play?
I actually think that we are on the brink of learning a lot, because we're now doing the genome-wide studies, which basically take a very controlled group of patients with PCOS who have really strong genetic traits, and they're studying them and comparing their genomes to other people. And so we're learning a lot from that, and that's just starting. So I think that's going to give us so much information on these different variants of PCOS, how to address them, what some of these mechanisms are. And I think once we have those details, then we can make more clear clinical guidelines. So I think that we're learning so much about nutrition, environment, epigenetics. So I think we're going to be accelerating a lot of, what we can do with complex conditions like this.
Because it still seems very much like it's a bit of a one size fits all. To take the pill and then until you want to get pregnant, then come off it, then go back on again. It just, medication seems to be this kind of like fire a big gun at it and hope it works. But you're saying a personalized approach where an individual's environment, nutrition, genetics, everything can then lead to a personalized response, a personalized medical response.
Exactly. Because what somebody needs as a 20-year-old who has acne, this person has PCOS, but it's going to be very different from what they need at 40 in perimenopause, and they still also have PCOS. So it's, the pill is sort of this basic option that they've had for all women's health conditions, to basically replace hormones with hormone-like substances that don't have similar effects, but will kind of manage other symptoms. So I think that cookie cutter approach has just been applied, but there's so much individuality. And when I work with my patients, even if they have the exact same problem, they'll all tell me that certain things matter to them more than other things. And that's really important, because for some people, whatever the pill does might not be important to them. And they might do better with something else that really addresses what they want to treat.
When you start working with patients, is there a common kind of light bulb moment where you say sometimes they can come in a little bit confused, unsure of what's been going on? Is there an approach where you start talking to them in a different way, where suddenly you can see behind their eyes, everything's beginning to fall into place? I'm just trying to get a sense of your approach and what's maybe missing from more traditional approaches.
Yeah, I would say the number one thing that I find is just listening to the person's story and hearing like how the PCOS has affected them. It's very different for each person. And most of the time, the patients are not listened to. So they go in, they're like, oh, I'm having these issues. They're like, go get an ultrasound. And then they're told, you have PCOS, take the pill and go away. So that experience is very, it's very disappointing. And so just having somebody to listen and go through like their health history, like how did this all affect you through your life? Like we see a lot of mental health disorders in PCOS, and like just really digging into the whole person. I find that really, really is amazing for patients to experience that. And I think that really just helps them feel like they're getting the care they need and want.
You mentioned awareness now and education, something that women are doing themselves. I think social media has played a huge part in that. There's so many experts now online offering advice, solutions, ways in which women can take back control of their health, fitness and fertility. Overall, obviously social media gets a lot of criticism, but do you feel that it's been a valuable tool or a distraction from some of the major issues when it comes to treating PCOS?
I would say overall, it's been amazing because the awareness is massive now. And there was a study, I can't remember, it came out a couple of years ago, and it showed like the Twitter, the tweets on PCOS and how much they've gone up just in the past, I think, 5 or 6 years. And it's a huge improvement. So I would say that part is amazing. And the fact that we can share information is also amazing. But then unfortunately, because the condition's very confusing, there's a lot of kind of misinformation or kind of summarizing into a very simple problem and then presenting these kind of one-size-fits-all solutions. And then people will put a lot of effort into that and it may not work for them. So it causes more confusion in certain ways too. So yeah, and I think that applies to a lot of different health areas right now too. Yeah.
I think as you say, there's the misinformation, there's the one size fits all approach. There's, especially with PCOS, pushing supplements as well without really necessarily understanding an individual. And there can be a lot of criticism of this area of health as well. As you mentioned, not just PCOS, a lot of areas of health popular on social media. How frustrating is it for you that I'm sure you've had this before, you've had people come to you and maybe seen other people online suggesting things and you're having to kind of then re-educate people? Does that happen a lot? And how frustrating is it?
It happens all the time. In fact, like I can sort of tell by what my patients are saying in a given week that some post has been made, because people will be like, oh, is this going to be the worst thing ever for me, this thing? And you know, then I'm getting like 5 or 6 people asking me that in a week. I'm like, oh, I bet that's coming from social media. So I think I spend more of my practice time now debunking myths and reassuring people about things than I used to before. So that is a little bit, you know, I just don't like that the anxiety is being created on, because it's so powerful. Like one big account can create mass anxiety in thousands of people very quickly. So that is, it's just a bit sad, but then at the same time, it also provides so much awareness. So
many people on social media now will be an expert, right? Because they'll read a couple of studies, the science is available, you can go online. You've obviously chosen a career path to take a much more holistic look at health. And unfortunately, I guess sometimes you can then be grouped in with people who are not medical doctors, who are taking maybe a more devious route to push supplements or to monetize people's insecurities. Have you experienced that before, where you are kind of grouped in with, I don't want to use the word, but I'm going to, you know, quacks online? And how damaging has that been to your message and to educating women?
I would say for me that I would say that that was more common in the beginning of my practice, where people didn't know as much what naturopathic doctors do. I have had some experiences like that also, but I tend to be quite evidence-based in what I say. So I try to ward that off in that I just try to really keep on top of all of the latest science. And I try to involve myself, you know, I was involved in the review of the PCOS guidelines. So I just try to like just be objective and share information. And I try not to let it affect me, because I just know what I'm doing. I'm just going to keep sharing the information I find. And I change what I think if I see new information. I don't believe in anything. I just read, learn, and share.
And I want to speak about that now, moving on to maybe a more positive, helpful note. Some of the recommendations, some of the suggestions you made, because having been through your book, and I'll hold it up here, 8 Steps to Reverse Your PCOS, you obviously outline 8 steps that women can take. Because as you mentioned, it's a more of a hormone issue than anything else, right? And that's where lifestyle interventions can have such a big impact. I don't necessarily want to go through them in any particular order, but you have outline those 8 steps. I was hoping we could talk with about addressing inflammation first, and why you put that as number one, why that is so important, and what sort of starting point can women begin to adapt in terms of lifestyle change to address inflammation?
Yeah, inflammation is actually one of the biggest problems for most chronic diseases, in that it's our body's mechanism really to either kill off infections or repair damaged tissues. And so that's a really good mechanism. It saves our life every day. And, you know, we need that there. But in PCOS and many other chronic conditions, we see chronic low-grade inflammation. And this is basically the immune system's just always activated. And when there is inflammation like this, it generates something called oxidative stress. And that can damage our cells or cause different changes in our cells that basically cause disease and aging and damage to our tissues. So because that's so foundational in that insulin resistance, which is a big part of PCOS, causes inflammation, and the other way around is true as well. That is a big problem, very central to PCOS. And the other very central element of PCOS is androgens, which are hormones like testosterone. So there's too much of these hormones, and those also cause inflammation in women, not in men, but in women, they do. And so this central inflammation is very disruptive to the overall physiology. So I view that as, you know, something really, really important in that it causes and is a central effect of some of those deeper root elements in PCOS.
And what are the first steps someone can do to begin to address inflammation?
Mm-hmm. So there's always looking at the underlying causes of inflammation. So if somebody has insulin resistance, it's working with nutrition, exercise, or supplements, for example, that can address that, different lifestyle changes. Somebody can also have inflammation that's coming from their gut, for example, or a chronic infection. So like treating these elements can be really important too. And then there's also treatments that directly manage inflammation, like antioxidants. We can, you know, do a lot of different things that improve inflammation in our body, like working on our gut health, our microbiome, eating foods that are more anti-inflammatory, and avoiding, you know, inflammatory types of foods in our life. So yeah, there's many different things that you can do for inflammation. It sort of varies by the person and what is causing inflammation in their case.
And then the second step you mentioned is managing the insulin resistance. I'm guessing all of your eight steps are, some are very closely related, others kind of are related, but it's all part of one overall picture, right? So with insulin resistance, can you talk a little bit about how this happens, firstly, why it's such a big issue, and again, some of the obvious steps women can begin to take?
Yeah, so insulin resistance is present in about 75% of patients who have PCOS. So insulin resistance basically means that your cells are not responsive to the effects of insulin, which normally helps us store energy. And when somebody's insulin resistant, they will gain weight much more easily, and it's very difficult to lose weight. It also causes weight gain around the midsection. So this is that visceral fat that's very inflammatory, very problematic for our health. It's associated with cardiovascular disease. And the reason that this is present in PCOS, there's a couple. One, there's genes that are linked to this. So certain people have genes for insulin resistance in PCOS. Secondly, there's more of a I heard a sound there and I went a bit off. The other thing that causes insulin resistance in PCOS is the androgen excess. So the high testosterone levels, this is a very interesting thing. At puberty, what happens is when girls go through puberty, most girls actually have high testosterone at the very beginning of puberty. This is actually normal. And when ovulation begins, the estrogen starts to take over, and ovulations become regular, periods come every month. With PCOS, there's an excess of testosterone. And right before puberty, the adrenal glands activate. This is called adrenarche. So this actually happens before puberty. We activate both DHEA, which in women turns into testosterone, and cortisol, which is our stress hormone. This causes weight gain. And this happens so that we can have babies, basically. So we gain weight so we can reproduce. And in PCOS, the testosterone portion is higher. And so this drives more insulin resistance right at that time with the combination of cortisol. And this can set the stage to develop a more severe insulin resistance. It's also been found that high androgens in women and adolescents especially can cause binge eating, mood disorders. So it's a kind of a vicious cycle that starts right at that time where that insulin resistance sets in this key window, the developmental window, which is basically puberty. So it's really interesting in that it's quite complex how it happens overall. The other element is that as a baby is developing in the womb, if there are PCOS genetics there and insulin resistance, this can turn on those genes for the baby later in life. So that person can develop more severe insulin resistance. And this is all part of the epigenetics element that we've been learning so much about lately.
And I guess that the response there will be similar to you outlined already. It's around exercise, diet, sleep, all the kind of the big rocks, essentially. Is that where people should be starting?
Yes. So those are really important. And the one thing I find is a lot of the patients who do very well, and this is really interesting, a lot of patients with PCOS are very good athletes. Like a lot of elite athletes have PCOS. The ones that do very well are often the ones that are athletes as adolescents, because they're exercising during that window of time. And so, but it's also complicated because there's a lot of eating disorders in PCOS in adolescents. So there's that balance between, you know, finding something that's really sustainable that the person likes to do that can use their natural abilities, and then avoiding triggering eating disorders when we're looking at nutrition. So finding like a really stabilizing approach to blood sugar, not super restrictive, because these are really teenagers. We have to be very careful, you know, with the way that we recommend nutrition to these patients in particular.
Let's jump ahead, since we're talking about nutrition now, to, because one of your steps is a balanced diet, right? So I guess I can imagine that probably alcohol and fast food and some of the obvious stuff is what should be avoided. Have I got the right end of the stick there? What's kind of your guidelines for how someone should eat?
Yeah, well, I sort of look at it as it's the most important thing is to focus on what you do eat rather than what you avoid. So really having balanced meals, and this is where I always start off with patients, learning like how to create a meal that's high in protein, that also has a lot of healthy fats in it. So things like nuts and seeds and avocados and olive oil, all of our Mediterranean healthy fats, and then lots of fiber, vegetables, salads and vegetables, and then a moderate amount of carbohydrate to go with that meal. So that meal structure is always where I start off, because this creates balanced blood sugar. And when people have balanced blood sugar, they just feel better. They can do more. They just feel more positive. So I start there. And then once they have that, I find most people don't want to eat or crave those foods as much because they already feel good. So, and then I, you know, try to include, because this is a lifelong thing, it's not really about losing weight for a time, it's like the rest of life. So to include favorite foods in moderation, but in ways that are not going to really cause blood sugar problems. So if somebody loves chocolate, you know, having some chocolate after dinner, just like having a really balanced dinner and having the chocolate then, so they can still enjoy these foods. And of course, minimizing, you know, a lot of these things like alcohol or fast food, but still being able to enjoy things in moderation. Can allow people to continue for the rest of their life. Because I find a lot of people with PCOS, they'll do, you know, they go off and on diets for their whole life, just yo-yoing. So these kinds of approaches tend to just make everything so much worse.
I guess, and that can be an even bigger issue, right? If you're losing weight and then gaining it, there is research that the yo-yoing is actually more dangerous than maintaining maybe a slightly higher weight. So it sounds as though the kind of nutrition approach is something that feels relatively controllable, and you've got the option there to make those choices, and you should see a benefit. With some of the other steps, you know, balance adrenals, treat excess androgens, balance your thyroid, they sound incredibly complex and quite scary. Can you talk a little bit about why these three steps are so important and where someone should begin?
Oh, yeah. So some of the steps apply to certain people and not to others, but I always consider that they can be present in anybody, because these are really, and they might change at different times in life too. So, for example, the thyroid, like some patients will have a condition called Hashimoto's, who have PCOS, which is an autoimmune thyroid condition. It's something like 30% of patients with PCOS will have this Hashimoto's thyroiditis. But at different phases in life, you know, say when they're 25 years old, they may not have that problem. But a woman gives birth and the top time in life to develop Hashimoto's is postpartum. So just checking in and knowing about all these things at different times and checking with their provider. So not really to worry, but just sort of to know that that's a possibility that could be treated because the thyroid really influences the metabolism. So it's very important. And the adrenals, because we see a lot of mental health concerns in PCOS. A study that recently came out estimated that the economic burden in the U.S. annually is $4.2 billion just for mental health disorders in PCOS, which was absolutely shocking to me. And, you know, and so the adrenal part is really more about stress, mental health, because the adrenals are just our responders to stress. But there are some adrenal hormones that actually are related to PCOS, like DHEA. So this is an area that I find very important for almost everyone, stress, mental health, looking at that area. And what was the last one that you asked me about?
The androgens, just with elevated testosterone as well. It's, I mean, because again, forgive me, Chris, you're the expert, right? So I'm just the guy asking the questions, but you think around kind of exercise and weight training for men that can elevate testosterone. So what about for women? Because obviously your testosterone levels are already elevated.
Yeah, this is such a good question because there's actually a dimorphic effect of androgens in men and women. So a lot of patients ask me this because, and this comes back to like research. There's just a lot more research, they don't include women in a lot of research. And, you know, even a lot of like journals will reject them before in the editorial process. So there's just a lot less research. So when we see those studies showing that testosterone goes up, which in men is great, like that's because the exercise is benefiting them. It's reducing inflammation and that their testosterone goes up. So in PCOS, the high testosterone is pathologic. It's not a good thing. It's something that's happening as part of the condition. When we see exercise in the picture, exercise improves insulin resistance. And insulin resistance in PCOS causes more testosterone production. So we see all the studies show us that it will lower testosterone in women with PCOS. So it's the exact opposite. But that's not the case in women without PCOS. It's different as well.
That's a pretty major difference then that a lot of people won't know about. You can have two women, one with PCOS and one without, and the effects of the stimulus of that weight training will have completely opposite effects, right?
Yes,
which is why it's so important that women need to know whether or not they've got it. And as you say, there's still a significant number of women undiagnosed or unaware that they've got the condition.
Yes, there's so many. And what I would say, the effect on testosterone reduction in women without PCOS or testosterone, that they might have a raise in testosterone, which is probably beneficial for them, but it's subtle, right? Like, but in PCOS, the high testosterone is not subtle. It is high and it is noticeable. And there are clinical signs of that. Like people will have hair growing on their face, acne, hair loss from their scalp, all kinds of physical signs. And so that reduction that can be achieved with exercise is not subtle in PCOS. It can bring it into the normal range from an abnormal high level because that testosterone is part of the whole condition, like the pathology of PCOS.
And what does the research tell us around the types of training? Again, being sympathetic to women at different stages of their life will respond differently to training. But are there any kind of golden rules of how someone should structure their training? I'm thinking around like cardio versus weights, for instance.
I'm really thankful you asked this because one of the things that's going around on social media is that certain exercise is harmful for PCOS, just across the board for PCOS. But there are no studies at all that show that any exercise is harmful for PCOS. In fact, they found every single type is beneficial. So that ranges from HIIT to strength training. All kinds of exercise have been shown to be beneficial. That doesn't include variation. Like certain people are too exhausted to exercise. Maybe they shouldn't be doing HIIT. You know, maybe there's something where they need to build up their iron is low, something else is wrong, but it's certainly not inherent to the condition of PCOS that, you know, one particular exercise is harmful. We know that they all are beneficial, but I think people have enjoy and do not enjoy certain types of exercise. So that I find to be relevant. I do find that strength training is a great tool because it can really improve insulin resistance. And patients with PCOS, because they have high testosterone, they can build muscle more easily. So it's a bit of a hack that they can have a little bit of an easier time with, and they can use that, especially, if they're able to build larger muscles like the leg muscles, which can make a significant difference for insulin resistance.
Of all the steps you suggest to your patients and online through social media, is beginning to exercise one you have the hardest job of convincing someone to begin? Because I'm just trying to picture what it might be like if you have had these health issues, if you're low of confidence, if there's visible signs, for instance, of PCOS. Stepping into a gym can be hard at the best of times for most people. Is this where sometimes you really have to really sell the benefits of exercise to get someone to do it?
The patients want to exercise, but a lot of them are like tired, depleted, or they're very inflamed, or they just feel disheartened by the whole thing. So a lot of the time what I'll do is I'll look for anything that I can correct to improve their energy, like their thyroid, anything that's making them tired, anything that's sucking their energy, chronic inflammation. I'll work on that first. Help them learn those basics of blood sugar balancing, how to eat so that sometimes people with PCOS, you'd be surprised, they eat very little and then they go and exercise and they're not able to tolerate it because they've been trained through eat less, don't eat this, don't eat that. And then they go to exercise and they're exhausted. So I try to get their nutrition in order, show them how to eat before they start. So then the exercise is more of a pleasant, enjoyable experience or start something they like. And then I find it goes really well, actually, if it's done this way, as opposed to just eat less, move more, go to Weight Watchers and, start doing step classes. Like most people are not going to continue that.
Because as you say, it's being positive about it, I guess, is to get that buy-in, to get somebody to keep doing it, to get that consistency. And another one, the final step you mentioned is create a healthy environment. Could you talk a little bit more about what that means? And also, Dr. McClark, specifically relating to you, because, as you say in your book, you were someone who gained weight around your middle. You tried everything. And again, you kind of had to use yourself to work out what was an approach that would benefit you. Could you kind of tell a story there of what it meant for you and what that healthy environment would look like for someone?
Yeah, the environment is really important. And interestingly, I'll just sort of chat about this briefly, but environmental endocrine disruptors like plastics, for example, are being implicated in causing PCOS because they can induce PCOS in animals by exposing pregnant animals to plastics. And the interesting thing is, it's very concerning, actually. There's a study where they have a pregnant rat. So if you imagine that pregnant rat has its baby rat inside, and that baby rat also, obviously has its ovaries. So inside that baby rat is the next generation. So we have two generations there. So they expose that rat in pregnancy, and the next generation has PCOS. This is to bisphenol A, one plastic, one exposure of bisphenol A plastic. So the next generation has PCOS. With no further exposures, the next generation also has PCOS. So that rat was not directly exposed, but it was in the ovary of the baby rat. But then the more concerning element is that rat's baby also had PCOS and there was no exposure there. So these, when it comes to environment, all of these plastics were jumping into the ocean, all of this stuff that's everywhere. This is very concerning. So I do include that because the less of that that we can do as a whole, the more we're going to see improvements with PCOS. For my own environment, just even generally, like when I was very young, I was very active as a teenager, but when I went to university, I wasn't, and I gained weight very quickly. I traveled and I gained, you know, quite a bit of weight. And then from that point, I started to struggle with insulin resistance, but I'd always had many of the symptoms of PCOS, with very irregular cycles, cystic acne, but I was undiagnosed. Back in those days, it just wasn't even thought of. I was sent to the dermatologist and nobody really asked me about these things. I went into the area that I'm in. I did my undergraduate in molecular biology genetics, and then for some reason became a naturopath. So I then learned a lot about nutrition and started applying those principles. And I had many improvements with my health. And then over the years, you know, I struggled with my metabolism many different times in life. After having children, and I started to study metabolism, and, you know, I had gestational diabetes despite eating very well. So these are all genetic links, and PCOS runs in my family. So I started to really study what works, what doesn't work, what's sustainable. And throughout the years, I've been able to really find approaches that are sustainable. And through working with, you know, my own health, but also many different patients. And I find that these balanced long-term approaches are what really work the best.
And it sounds as though, I guess, why some people get drawn down to the oral contraceptive, because it's kind of like it's a plaster, right? It means you just don't have to do anything else. Where from your own journey and some of your patients you've talked about, it's a bit of a war, right? It's like there's never a decisive battle. You've just got to keep on and keep on. Is that... have I hit the nail on the head there? Is that essentially how you manage this condition until down the line a cure can come?
What I find is once you've found what works, it's actually really easy to keep it there. It's more like getting through the wall of, like, if a person has insulin resistance or very high androgens. So it's just finding that, like, treatment that the person can do for a long time, because once they've really gotten there, it's actually really easy to keep things managed. So I think that's actually, you know, the hardest part of all of it. And the pill is just offered right at the very beginning. So nothing's ever tried, and it actually makes insulin resistance worse. So it's not, you know, it's not even addressing a lot of it. So yeah, it takes more effort and time to work with PCOS. It's not a simple pill solution type of condition. Yeah.
I was hoping we could just circle back, just because you mentioned thyroid health there. And I think it's one of those areas that's not really talked about unless you've got a problem. It's not one of the kind of the headline things that you read articles about or see people interviewed about. Could you tell us a little bit more about just why thyroid health is so significant to female wellness, and then what people, again, can do? I'm always looking for some actionable steps that people maybe can just stack the odds slightly in their favor.
Definitely. Yeah. So thyroid conditions are extremely common in that many people have them, men and women, and it causes vague symptoms. So the symptoms are often fatigue, brain fog, feeling cold, feeling tired and sluggish, but it can be easily perceived almost as normal in some cases where, you know, the person's like, well, I'm just not feeling so great. But it also increases the risk for cardiovascular disease, like cholesterol goes up and all kinds of things. So because it's so common, and because the thyroid is very, very sensitive to other hormones like estrogen, so menopause, postpartum, all these times are times that the thyroid has undergone stress, and it really can change at those times. So I think one of the most important things is to test your thyroid anytime that there's a major hormone shift. That includes menopause, postpartum, coming off or on birth control, but, you know, weight loss and weight gain. People don't think of that as a hormone change, but there's a huge hormone change when we have weight loss or weight gain, especially with the hormone insulin. And this can really change the thyroid. Inflammatory conditions as well. So it's just identifying it. There's a few important things that are, you know, that are very simple that can help the thyroid. One is the antioxidant selenium. So selenium, there's a large store of selenium inside our thyroid, and it acts like a sponge. So if there's what I was talking about before, oxidative stress or inflammation, selenium can act as a sponge and protect the thyroid from that. So ensuring that you're adequate in selenium, or on, you know, a multivitamin that includes some selenium, because a lot of the soil is depleted in selenium. Another thing that I find very helpful is to not overdo iodine. So iodine has a sweet spot for thyroid, and you don't want to be too low. But in the developed world, it's quite difficult to be too low in iodine. Most people are on the high side with iodine. Too much iodine can cause Hashimoto's, thyroiditis. In areas of the world where there is more iodine consumption, there are higher incidences of Hashimoto's. So just watching that you're not over-consuming iodine, iodine drops that are concentrated iodine, these types of things, because we can just accumulate a lot of iodine. So I would say these are definitely the most important areas to look at for thyroid.
And I appreciate there is no kind of one size fits all, but when it comes to dietary supplementation around PCOS, are there any kind of go-tos that anyone suffering from the condition should consider, again, around insulin resistance or androgens or any other herbs or supplements that people should consider?
Yeah, so the most researched supplement for PCOS is inositol. There is a lot of research on this. It was actually included in the 2023 PCOS guidelines, which is a huge win because normally there are no supplements ever included in the regular standard of care. So this is really awesome because they, you know, there needs to be a lot of evidence to get into the guidelines. So inositol, there are combinations of inositol, but it's primarily myo-inositol. That's the type that should be taken. And a small amount of D-chiro-inositol can be added to that. That supplement can help with all types of PCOS because it helps insulin resistance, but it also helps with the ovary itself and ovulation and testosterone. So even if someone's not insulin resistant, it's still quite beneficial. Some other ones that are very popular, berberine is quite popular for PCOS, in particular for insulin resistance. It has outperformed metformin in several trials and definitely can give clinical results, but that one's really more for patients with insulin resistance. And another treatment that I use all the time in my practice is cyclic progesterone therapy. This treatment is probably one of the most effective treatments for PCOS that is also the least known about. There's a researcher at UBC. Her name's Dr. Jerry Lynn Pryor. So she's dedicated almost her entire career to researching cyclic progesterone therapy. And it can lower androgens in PCOS. It can prevent thickening of the lining, which is one of the reasons they use birth control pills. But it allows the natural production of hormones, so it doesn't replace the hormones like birth control pills because it's given half of the month on, half of the month off. And it can work on some of the deeper issues in PCOS if you look at the mechanisms of it. So this does require a prescription, but it's very effective, and it's something I use all the time in my practice, and I see great results in labs with this.
And finally, Dr. McCulloch, I want you to look into your crystal ball now. Looking 10, maybe 20 years down the line, what will our conversation be around PCOS? Are we going to be having the same conversation that we've had today, or do you think it's going to be significantly different? And if so, why?
I personally think there's going to be personalized medicine will be applied to it because it is so individual. And I think, you know, with everything that's happening with technology now and genetics, I can imagine we're going to have individualized plans and ways to analyze and then take, you know, things that actually match us in a much more specific way. That's my hope anyway, because I can see it's all going to be possible. And I think it'll just depend on if it's applied to PCOS. But I really do think that that will be in our future.
And will there be a cure, or is this just something we'll just have to get better at managing and there'll never be an outright solution to it?
So the interesting thing with PCOS is it's actually, I view it more as a type of person because some of these genes actually are survival genes and are prevalent in a large amount of the population. And men have them too. You just can't see the disorder because the testosterone looks normal for them. So basically the genes are for insulin resistance are genes that are make us better at storing energy. So that is very beneficial if we look at biology. So that won't go away really, but you know, we can manage the pathology that's linked to that very well. And the androgen genes are similar in that they think that these genes persisted in women for various reasons. One in that they can increase certain kinds of strength and visual acuity and different things like this. And secondly, the other interesting thing is that women with PCOS can have children later in life because these androgens extend the reproductive window. So I don't think those genes will go away, but I think the pathology around the genes, we can address all of that. And then, you know, we can sort of see that PCOS is really a variation of genetics that, you know, the environment is making into a problem, basically.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.